Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have back here on the program once again Scott Spiess from the Spiess Home Inspection Service. We do these programs generally with Scott. Sometimes that other guy, Hank, stops by if Scott's not available. One or the other of them is here on the program once a month, and we invite questions on home maintenance. So if you have a problem, something needs to be fixed, you're not quite sure how to deal with it, give us a call. Scott will do his best to help you out. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, David. I tell you what, after walking in this morning from the parking lot, I was kind of hoping we could do it outside where it's 63 degrees or 65 degrees and bright and sunny.
That would be pretty nice. It looks like we could have one of the nicest weeks we've had, I don't know, maybe all year so far. At least it sounds like it's going to be dry. And for people who are doing things outside, that's going to be a real good thing. But after all of the rain, we were talking just a little bit before we got going here, after all of the rain here in Champaign-Urbana, I'm sure a lot of other places have had really impressive amounts of rain, really all through the spring, but here just over the last week or so. So if people have water in their basements or have other kinds of water issues, nobody would be surprised, probably.
This is true.
Well, I tell you what, we got several callers here lined up and ready to go. So let's start right in and let's talk with somebody in Lafayette. And they're on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
This about water. When firemen are working on a burning house, could a charge, a bolt, come down to them in the stream of water?
Oh, most definitely. One of the first things that they do in case of a fire is to disconnect utilities to the house just for that very reason, because, yes, that is a very real possibility.
And when a power line, breaks and falls to the road, and it sparks and booms for a while and then seems dead, is it dead?
Normally, this is not quite a residential question, but the experiences that I've had normally is that there is a breaker that will trip. Once the line has fallen, there is a series of breakers in the power line that will attempt to reset it once there's been a power surge. Usually it tries about three times, and if that doesn't work on the automatic setting, then it goes ahead and fails until they reset it manually. So usually those are dead, but with any power line, if it's down, I am not going to be the one to determine that it doesn't have power.
Or approach it through a puddle.
Yeah, water and electricity do not work well.
Okay. A question just in history. You never see any more of lightning rods, and yet I understand they were pretty successful.
Lightning rods, we still see them quite a bit in rural properties. We don't see them quite anywhere near as much in residential. A lot of it has to do with the fact that the residential nowadays, we've got enough tall trees and stuff in the city that they act as natural grounding rods when you have a tree higher than the house. We've also got a lot better electronics these days. So unless you have a direct lightning strike, you can survive most of it with surge protectors and things like that. But, I will still say that if you've got some sensitive equipment, that lightning rods are not a bad idea.
Okay. I just don't see them anymore in town.
Yeah, I agree. And most of the time in town, what we rely on is the natural grounding rods, and that would be the trees, which are so prevalent in all of our nice neighborhoods these days.
Anything in our guttering or downspouts that would make a ground?
Well, everything that's aluminum or will conduct electricity, so yes, they can. It does help to attach a ground rod to them. The biggest problem with an aluminum gutter is if you get a lightning strike, the current in it is enough that the aluminum is almost going to evaporate. The aluminum it conducts electricity nicely, but it's such a thin gauge that once you put that much heat to it, the aluminum won't last long. That's why they used a heavy steel cable on the lightning rods that you put on the roof.
Okay, so I could use a rod connected to my downspout.
Yes, yes.
Okay, thank you, sir.
All right, other questions here. Let's go next to our line number one.
So is that me?
In Champaign. Yes, go ahead.
When my garage was built, they put in a some sheet aluminum, I believe it is, between the footing and the plate, this wooden part, you know, wooden 2x6 that they use to put the attach the studs to. And the sheet of aluminum, I guess, is some kind of an insect guard or maybe a rodent guard. I'm not sure exactly what its purpose is. But it sticks out about 2 inches into the garage, past the plate. And what I'd like to do is to be able to cut that off so that I can put stuff up against the wall. It's a little inconvenient, because it prevents leaning things up against the wall. It also, if you get real close to it, it'll actually cut your ankles. But I don't know whether, I should do that or not, whether it's actually serving some function as it is, and maybe I shouldn't cut it off, or maybe just by leaning stuff up against the wall, I'm defeating the purpose of it in the first place.
Okay, the metal shield is generally considered to be the termite shield.
Yeah.
And that is because we do have a subterranean termite in this area, and so they come up from underground.
Uh-huh.
Usually means that the garage is sitting on a concrete block foundation rather than a poured concrete foundation.
Well, this one is poured concrete.
It is poured concrete.
Yep.
There's nothing to say that you can't take that aluminum shield and fold it either up or down. Basically, what the shield is designed to do is if any termites coming up from below have to go out around that shield before getting up to the wood framing.
Mm-hmm.
And the aluminum is smooth enough that the sand tubes that they build to crawl inside of don't stick well, so their tunnel keeps falling apart, so
well,
it tends to discourage them.
Wouldn't they be coming in from the outside, not the inside?
Not necessarily, because your interior concrete floor is a floating slab, so there is a crack between the floor and the foundation wall in most cases.
Okay.
And a termite can actually fit through a crack. I believe it's about a 64th of an inch wide.
Uh-huh.
So even the aluminum plates or other, I've seen copper and other things used for this termite shield, unless they're soldered together or folded together, the termites can usually get around it at the corners anyway. It does help somewhat. If it's in the way, there's no reason why you couldn't trim it back or even, for that matter, fold it down over the top of the foundation so that it's flush with the foundation and not sticking out.
Yeah, I tried that in one corner, but I can't get it folded. It's too stiff. It folds part way and then it doesn't go all the way. I'd have to, like, screw it to the foundation or something like that, and I don't want to go to that trouble. So.
Well, generally, if you've got a dry garage,
yeah,
you stay on top of things like the roofing so we don't have roof leaks and such.
Right.
I don't see any problem with trimming that back. You do want to leave a little bit of it exposed out from underneath the sill plate, but not necessarily, it doesn't need to stick out several inches.
Yeah, okay. All right, so how much should it stick out then?
Since it's just a shield that the termites are going around, there's really no set depth or set length.
Okay.
What the idea behind it is that we want not only for the termites to have to build around it to where that their tubes come apart, but also it brings them out to the surface where they are visible so that when a termite inspector comes through and looks for termites, the sand tubes go out and around this thing. So it brings it out to where instead of being able to go straight from the concrete right into the bottom of the sill plate, they have to come out around this plate.
Yeah, okay, all right. Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, certainly. Thank you. Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. This is a program we do every month, always on a Monday, to take questions on home maintenance. So if you got a problem, give us a call, 333-9455, and toll free, 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have water in my basement. When I bought my house, I hired somebody to tell me what to do about it. He recommended a sump pump. I hired the person he recommended. And the sump pump works, but no water runs into it. And when I called back and said, what's happening, he said that in time it would run under the cement floor instead of on top of it. But 15 years later, it's on top. What happens if I put an appropriate sealant into the cement lines, you know, those seams they put in? Because some of the water is coming up those seams and running across the top of the floor. And I have to wet vac it up and dump it into the sump pump. And I was wondering if it's going to make more cracks and force it up through the up other places, or if that would be a way to make it go underneath the way it's supposed to be.
Well, of course, with the rains we had, Dave and I were talking earlier that the basement, so all over Champaign-Urbana, are wet. Depends on where your water's coming from. There are generally two types of water sources. One is a surface source, and one is a hydronic pressure or high water table, or rather than a high water table, what I like to refer to as a perched water table, something that some water that's sitting on top of a clay layer that will let water through it, but it lets it through at its own rate, so it tends to build up when we have heavy deluge rains like we had in the last week or so. If the water is actually bubbling up or forcing its way up through the cracks in the floor, I'm really surprised that we're not getting more water to the sump pump, because generally speaking, water does not like to go uphill. It does like to seek a nice flat level, and the sump pump being below the grade or below the basement floor, usually that water will force its way to that sump pump as long as there are sufficient holes in the sump pump. They haven't blocked up with silt and things like that. The other thing would be is maybe the water is coming from the foundation wall and actually getting into your expansion joints. The expansion joints themselves are not creating the water problem. That just happens to be where things are showing. And the cracks in the foundation, or cracks in, not in the foundation, but in the concrete slab, are normal. All concrete slabs will have some cracking. They put those joints in there so that we can actually use them as control joints and have the cracks be in nice straight lines instead of jagged and all over and looking random down the basement. So it's kind of depending on whether or not that water is coming from the foundation wall or whether or not we actually have a hydronic pressure underneath. If we have a hydronic pressure underneath, then we need to look into the sump pump to see whether or not there's some adequate holes in the sides of the sump pump.
Well, there's great big, like, 4 or 5 inch pipe.
A couple of tiles from the from around the outside.
Yeah, there are, and there's actually above the height of the floor itself are some holes. And since there's about 3 inches of water, some of it is going in through those little holes. But
that's fine.
We had a sump pump in my dad's house, and it didn't work that way. It all ran in through those big tiles, and then it was sent out, and it never was all over the floor like that. What about a portable sump pump, and if that's appropriate, and run it into the sump pump? The sump pump works, but I really don't want to wet back out 3 or 4 inches of water all over the basement. It's really, really a lot. Would that work, a portable sump pump?
Well, the problem with most of the portable units is it's very difficult to suck water off of a flat surface unless there is a puddle of several inches for it to pull from. As soon as it tries, you know, when you get a flat surface, as soon as the pump tries to pull from it, it goes right down to the concrete, and we have to wait for more water to get to it. So a surface pump does not work well unless it's really very deep in the basement. And if it's very deep in the basement, then your sump pump should already be taking care of it, because it would be flowing that way, unless they put the sump pump in the highest portion of the basement.
I don't know about that. I let the person who put it in, the person who recommended it, decide where it went.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly is awfully deep down there. If I were to get a floor kind of sump pump, what am I looking for? I mean, if I pay more, will it work better? Will it go down further, deeper into the...
No, because the sump pump doesn't work like on a suction, like a shop vac would. A sump pump actually has to use an impeller to force water. So unless the impeller is submerged in water, it's not going to move water. So that's why about the only way you can get water off of a surface is a suction system, which would be your wet vac. There's no pump that would provide that type of suction. That's why we have to put in the sump pit. The whole reason for the sump pit is to allow the water to collect enough that we can get the sump pump to actually be submersed to where we can get grab a hold of the water and start moving the water.
Does that mean I have to put another sump pit in someplace else?
Again, I'm not going to say that without knowing exactly where the water is coming from. So a sump pump is a solution to a symptom, not a solution to a problem. If you've got water coming in the basement, the problem isn't how do I pump it out. The problem is where is it coming from and how do I keep it from getting there? So until we have a little bit more idea on where that water is coming from and whether or not we can deter it before it gets into the basement, that's something that I would work with before I would put a second sump pump in.
Is it possible to put some kind of marker or dye so that I could see if it was coming off my neighbor's driveway or something like that?
Usually, if somebody that is trained or somebody that's worked with water problems before, it's pretty easy to determine whether or not it's a surface drainage. If you've got some efflorescence on the basement wall, some crystallizing little white flakes and such, that's usually an indication of surface drainage. Walk around the outside and look and see if it looks like any of the yard slopes back towards the foundation. Make sure all your guttering and such is 3 to 5 feet away from that basement wall so that the
I've done that. I'm sure of that.
Does the water seem to be in the corners or in the middle of the basement, or where does it seem to be coming from?
I guess in the middle. I mean, mostly I think there's a set of seams that I can see it coming up through those expansion joints.
Okay, well, it may be that we need to put in a different something, a different location. Usually the basement floor slab is set on a sand and gravel base. That sand and gravel base is usually about 4 to 6 inches thick, and that's why a sump pump does work well. Before the water actually builds up enough pressure to come up through the cracks, it usually the same pressure will force it laterally through that sand and gravel and get over to the sump pump. So if your water is not getting to the sump pump, it's not forcing through there, like I say, we need to do a little bit of work on where the actual source is. I would have somebody, I don't know if you're in our area here.
I'm near Lincoln Square. The house okay. probably was built in about 1914. Does that mean they didn't put it on sand and gravel?
In 1914, anything was possible. They didn't have the same type of stringent building codes we have today, so I don't know. This is one where probably the only way to really determine where it's coming from would be to come out and take a look at it, not something that we can really do over the radio here. So if you wanted to give a call over the office for myself or any of the other inspectors in the area, feel free to do that. And I think it's going to take a little bit more work than what I can do here.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call. We'll continue. The next person here is on our line number one. This is also somebody in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of problems, but I'll ask you about the most concerning one, I guess. We moved into the house about a year ago. It was built in 1960, and the home inspector A-OK'd it. And we noticed some water damage coming out around the ceiling and just around where the dryer vent goes up.
Okay.
So we thought that was an old event and that we didn't need to worry about that. Well, the last deluge we had, I thought I'd take a look at it, and come to find out, all the ceiling around where that comes out is wet, and it comes through. It actually it goes through kind of a cupboard thing, so all the shelves where it comes out are wet, and there's mildew on the ceiling. So we get up on the roof and take a look at it, and it's this dryer vent that, it looks like it should be coming out of a wall. I mean, it's just totally open, and then there's no flashing. It's just kind of, it's got some, what's the word I'm looking for? Some caulk all around it that's obviously coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So my husband took some more caulk and put it up there, kind of as a temporary solution, but what would you recommend to solve that problem? Do we need to route it out one of the walls, or can we put some flashing up there, or what are our options?
Yeah, there are definitely good and bad penetration fixtures for something for a dryer. Some of them work well, some of them don't. Some of them have a good flashing around them. It sounds to me like what we need to do is get a different type of fixture to go through the roof, something that can be flashed a little bit better. Mm-hmm. Really, roofing tar or sealants are more for after you've had a problem. Usually if something is installed properly, you don't need to put a sealant around it. On a dryer vent, depending on how far you are from an eave, one of the things you can do is mount it your fixture that goes through the ceiling or through the wall. You can mount it in the bottom of the eave so that it actually points downward, and that way it's underneath the overhang where the water doesn't get to it. Of course, with a dryer, any dryer, the shorter the run, the more efficient the dryer will operate. So depending on where your dryer is located in the house, where we can vent it out, you want to try and take it the shortest route possible, because the more air that the dryer moves, the faster it can pull the moisture out of the clothing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that we're probably on a slab, which is why they ran it out through the attic.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds to me like what we need to do is get a different fitting on the roof, something that's got a proper flashing around it so that we're not getting the leaks around that
the hose pipe. Okay, so we don't necessarily need to route it through the wall as long as we find something appropriate that'll go through the roof.
That is correct, and most roofers should be able to do that fairly easily. There are several different types of hoods or capped type aluminum fittings that will go through the roof and have about an 8 or a 9 inch wide flashing around it that can tuck up underneath the shingles.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Next caller is in Champaign, and that's line number 3. Hello.
93.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I have a question for my aunt, so I don't have too much information, but her question is that she has a cellar as opposed to a basement in a house that's probably about 100 years old. Her concern is that she has a gas water heater, and if her cellar floods, as it has in the past, is her gas water heater going to be a danger? Would the pilot light go out and gas escape?
Okay. The water heaters of the last 40 years or so.
She said it's about 25 years old.
Yeah, we should be in good shape. The pilot light, the gas line for the pilot light, actually heats a thermocouple, and that thermocouple keeps the gas line open. If the pilot light goes out, that thermocouple will cool down, and it shuts the gas off to the pilot light. And with the gas off to the pilot light, the gas valve for the main burner will not open. So as soon as the pilot light goes out, within a few moments of when that pilot light goes out, the gas valve is shut off completely, and so there is no gas coming in from there.
Okay, that should help her sleep. And I have a question also for me, because I have an old house also, but I'm here in town, and I'd like to stay in it for quite a long time, and I wonder, is it appropriate to call someone like you to come in, go over the house, and give me suggestions about how I should spend money that I don't have much of to keep it, you know, functioning for as well and as long as possible? Is that the kind of things you do?
Yes. Myself and most home inspectors will do
right.
What we call a maintenance inspection.
Okay.
And it's not necessarily part of a sale, but to have somebody come through there, and it's particularly if you've got one or two issues that you're concerned with and don't know which direction to go to.
Exactly.
But a trained eye, I can walk through a house in usually an hour and a half or 2 hours, and I can spot more things than most people know about after living there for about 4 or 5 years.
How
just because I've seen so many things. You know, I've been in like 7 or 8,000 houses, so
yeah.
It doesn't
okay.
take much to catch my eye and point me in a direction of where there could be a potential problem.
And so you call that a maintenance inspection?
Yes, a maintenance inspection.
Okay, fine. Thanks.
All right.
Bye.
Very good. We're at our midpoint already. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's here on the program once a month, always on a Monday, and we talk about home maintenance. And if you have questions, call us. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Up next, someone over in Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful morning. Got a bit of a problem here that I don't know if you can help me with. Live in a house that my father-in-law built 50 years ago, and I'm going around and replacing the windows. And I'm replacing them with high-end windows, and not to mention a brand, but the one where the grill blows up out back while the wife's showing it off. those particular type, excellent windows. But I've noticed a particular problem I have on the south side of my building where I've got a fairly large group of windows. I've been noticing a lot of birds have been running into them. And I'm wondering, do you know of a way we can stop to... I can close the blinds. I don't know if that keeps the reflection down for them or what. Is there a product that you can put on them or anything?
You might be able to get a translucent film, sort of like a window tint type film,
mm-hmm.
Which would have a more of a dull appearance. What's happening is the large group of windows is reflecting things
yeah.
well enough that they see what they think they can get through or see another group of trees.
I think it's the great outdoors.
Yeah. So you almost need to dull the surface a little bit. Don't wash the windows quite as often.
Yeah.
But you might try putting a plastic film. There's you check with some of the window companies. I'm sure that they've got some UV type films that will help not only dull some of the reflection, but also help reduce some of the sunlight, the UV damage that can come in through the window. That's relatively easy to apply.
Yeah, I had an indigo bunting and a goldfinch both hit it this weekend, and I said, nah, it's time to do something about this.
Well, the other thing is you might plant a plastic owl outside the window so that the nice birds like that tend to stay a little bit farther away from the house.
That's a thought. That'd probably be easier than anything else, wouldn't it?
Yeah, just put a prey of some sort, scarecrow out there, and that way they're a little less tempted to come right towards the house.
Hey, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. Next up is Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yes, this is line two.
Yes.
I'm from Urbana, and I was wondering if Mr. Spies could tell me the difference between a deck cleaner and a deck brightener.
They're both about the same thing, a couple of different chemicals. The cleaners and brighteners are designed to help take out the grain, wash off the dead wood cells. Generally speaking, when a deck starts to really turn gray, that's the surface wood cells are deteriorating with a little bit of sunlight. And so the washes, the brighteners, the cleaners are designed to help take off that top layer of dead wood cells, which brings back some of the natural color of the wood. Most of the time, the chemicals are fairly close to the same. Oxalic acid works well, a couple other different materials that do pretty well. Once you've cleaned it, then, of course, it does help to put some type of UV protectant over it, some type of sealant, not necessarily to really completely seal it, but something more of a water repellent so that we can that has some UV protectants in it.
What about the mildew and mold?
Well, the mildew and mold is growing on dirt that's collecting in the deck. And usually indicates that we have a very high shade area, so we're not getting much sunlight to it. And so, again, the sealants or the protectants have a little bit of an algaecide in it to help reduce this growth that you're seeing.
Right.
So, yes, cleaning the deck, and that's where your deck cleaners, your deck brighteners will work best, is they'll help pull off the old dead wood that the plant organisms are growing in. They will help or at least the damaged wood from the UV, it will help remove some of the dirt. But then it would be up to you to get some type of sealant over the top of it to help reduce the chances of the growth coming back.
But will it remove the deck cleaner, remove the green?
For the most part, yes, it will.
It will. And will it have any more deteriorating effect on the deck or the shingle than the brighteners?
No, it should not. The deck being a pressure-treated deck, the water is not going to – the water and the chemical are not really going to affect the boards. It's not like it really soaks in there and damages the wood additionally. It does a pretty good job of just cleaning the surface of it and getting rid of the UV damage.
And what about a shingle on the side of the house?
The shingles, you got some mildews and such on the mildew, on the shingles?
There's a cedar shingle, yeah, that has some.
They do make a spray or a chemical that can be put on the wood shingles, which will help reduce the growth. Again, an algaecide type of product. A couple of the painting companies in town I know at one time were applying that. Off the top of my head, I don't know what it was that they were using, but it's basically your stains and such. These days do not have the chemicals they used to have, so they are more susceptible to mildew growth because we don't have, well, for one, lead, things like that, which actually help prevent the plant growth.
Well, these shingles have a UV-heavy water seal on them, but that's all. But they're still growing, but it's been some time. Maybe just needs another coat of that.
Again, you'll probably have to clean them a little bit. I probably would not use a real strong high-pressure washer because cedar is a relatively soft material.
Right.
But something with a medium-firm brush, something like a brush they use for cleaning motorhomes and such, where you have a nice long wand so you can reach all the way up to the top.
Right.
To brush off the existing stuff, you may want to take and spray it lightly with a water and Clorox solution to help kill off the algae / mold before you do the cleaning. Spray it down first and let that let the plant growth die off, and then go back and wash off the residue that's left over.
Oh, that sounds like a great idea. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank
very
you.
Good. Thank you. We'll continue. And the next caller is in Champaign, and no, it's in Urbana. How about that? Line number three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Question is, right now my sump pump exits the house with PVC piping into the front yard, and the PVC piping is just running across the top of the lawn and exiting the water into the lawn about 10 feet out. What I'd like to do is bury it and have the water just go back into the soil. So my question, my basic question is, what's the best way to do that with subparts of how deep should it be, how should the water exit, i.e. should it go into like an underground gravel pit and stuff like that?
Okay, well, unfortunately, the soils we have around here, once you start digging down, you'll find instead of this nice black dirt that we've got on the surface, we've got a fairly high clay mixture. So going down into the soil, if there's a little bit of water, yes, we may get some percolation and allow that to go down. But if it's a lot of water, such as what usually comes out of a sump pump, you're not going to have a lot of luck getting all of it to soak down into the ground. I would recommend burying it because, among other things, in the wintertime, if that pump runs, we need to be able to make sure that that water doesn't freeze inside the pipe.
And then how deep should that be?
So usually in this area, we don't get any hard freezes that go much below about 6 or 8 inches.
Okay.
So it's not like you have to bury it 2 feet down.
Okay.
So if you were to dig a trench, you know, 10 or 12 inches down and put a 3-inch pipe in there, that'll make sure that you're at least 8 inches down below the grade for your top of your pipe.
Okay.
And that should be sufficient. I was over at one of the do-it-yourself stores there on North Prospect over the weekend and noticed that they do have some what they call a bubbler pot or a drain pot. Has a grate on it. It was about the size of a small laundry pail or a regular bucket. And you bury it in the ground and had a grate. You could put that into the ground and put your pump into there and drill some holes in it to allow the water to drain out the bottom of it.
Uh-huh.
But then put some gravel or stuff off, some loose or large gravel over the top of it and so that the water could actually bubble up should it actually come out faster than what the ground could take it.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And that will allow it to dissipate across the surface. And then the whatever's left in the bucket will then just drain down through the holes in the bottom of it.
Is this a bucket? It's called a drain bucket?
I noticed it over in the drainage area.
Uh-huh.
There's a couple of different brands and different styles for things like that. A lot of times they'll use them as collectors where they put them in a low spot and they want to run a drain from it. You're going to be going actually the other direction and pumping water to it. So you'll have to get something that hopefully the lid can be affixed to, or you can put some gravel or something over the top of it. My best suggestion there would be to go to look and see what they've got as far as what would work for your application or what you feel would look good in that particular area.
And does this look something like the bucket that the sump pump is in the basement?
Only on a much smaller scale. Something, you know, that is usually the sump pump is 20 inches across by 24 inches deep.
Uh-huh.
Since you're only going 8 inches down into the ground, we don't need something that's going to be that deep for the most part. So you can find something that's maybe 12 or 14 inches deep.
Okay. And if right now my PVC piping is less than 3 inches, should I get a coupler to make the rest of it from the house on out?
No, you should be all right. Most sump pumps actually do come off at a 1.5 or even a 2-inch pipe.
And that's what I have.
Yeah, that'll be fine.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right, very good. And we'll continue. And next, we'll talk with someone in Mentino on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
My question has to do with home heating.
Okay.
I have a two-story older home that's been heated with hot water heat and using oil in my boiler. And I was wondering if it would be cost-effective or more efficient to change to LP gas.
Generally speaking, the LP units are much more efficient with the old oil burners. They're also much cleaner so that they require a lot less maintenance. So in the long run, yeah, I think that is a very good possibility that you will be saving quite a bit of money by switching over to LP.
So I wouldn't be able to use the old boiler. I would have to change the complete furnace.
Yeah, but the chances are your old oil furnace or old oil burning boiler has probably got an efficiency of no more than 60% and quite possibly down around 45% or 50% depending on how old that particular boiler is. So the newer LP unit would most likely have an efficiency rating in the 80% range or even up to the 90% range. So you're going to gain quite a bit of efficiency just by moving to a newer boiler. I don't know how old your oil unit is.
Well, it's about probably 20 years old.
Okay. Well, it may not be quite that bad. It may be as good as about 60 or 65%. But like I say, the new LP units are available into the 90, upper 90 range.
Uh-huh. Well, what about cost for a boiler like that? Yeah, what range would I be looking at?
Well, boilers can get expensive. Most of the time, if you're putting in the boiler and end up with a high efficiency where you have to run a new flue and such, you can be plus or minus a couple thousand in the $6,000 range. You know, anywhere from, I'd say anywhere from probably $4,800 up to $68,000 or $7,000 even.
I see. Well, I have a two-story house, and I got a real tall chimney. Does that have any effect on it?
Well, the higher the efficiency of the boiler you get, the less likely you're going to be using the chimney. On the very high efficiency units, we can't put it into a masonry-style chimney because they actually, the flue gases are cool enough that they won't heat the chimney, so we end up with condensation in the chimney, which actually deteriorates the chimney from the inside. The very high efficiency, the 90-plus units, actually vent through PVC pipe through the side of the house and don't use the chimney.
Well, is it worth it to go to the extra expense of the high efficiency furnace versus maybe a lesser efficient one?
Well, I don't think at the moment you're even allowed to manufacture anything less than 80% efficient. The 80 to 85% efficient units are what they call an induced draft system, where they have a fan that moves the air through the flue pipe. And most of those will require at least a liner in the chimney.
I already have that.
You have a liner in the chimney, then yes. You could probably get by with the 80% or so, or 85%, and not have to put in the 90 and not have to change the flue system.
Uh-huh.
So that would save you a little bit of money. You're going to have to shop around because when it comes to hydronic heat like that, there are a fairly large discrepancies between one company and another depending on how much plumbing they're going to actually have to do to hook the boiler up, depending on the style of the boiler.
If I had further questions, do you have a number I could call your office?
We are listed in the Yellow Pages under Spies Home Inspection Service, and there are a few other inspectors here in town that have some type of information about that. My father actually has done quite a bit with hot water because he does have hot water in his house, and he was with the University of Illinois Small Homes Council building research where they did a lot of research and even have a brochure of modernizing your hydronic system or hydronic heating systems.
Well, is there a way I could get that or talk to him?
Jeff, you're okay.
Our number here in Champaign for the office is area code 217-356
5048. Okay, thank you.
All right, very good. We are coming into about our last 10-12 minutes here in this part of Focus 580. Scott Spies is the guest. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program once a month on a Monday, and we talk about home maintenance, and we will take as many questions as we can in the time that's left. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number, toll-free 800. 222-9455. Next is someone in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I am going to be replacing a porch floor on a Queen Anne type house. It's a wraparound porch. And some neighbors just had their porch floor replaced with, I don't know what you call it. Anyway, it's not real wood. It's something that has a grain in it. And when I talked to them, they said that their contractor told them that it would last forever and never have to be painted. And can you kind of compare that with pressure-treated wood? And it's going to be a big job. And I want it to last my lifetime. I don't want to do it again.
Cost effectiveness might be something that can be considered because generally pressure-treated lumber is the least expensive way to go. There are some plastic materials which have a wood graining imprinted on them.
Right.
Basically, a recycled milk jugs is what they make it out of. And as people are going more and more green, it is a product. It is good as far as durability goes. It is a recycled product, so it of course, is not using our natural resources. I've seen more and more decks becoming built with this this plastic wood. I'm not real familiar with most of the brand names because, of course, by the time I get to it, the brand name is not stamped on the box. I see it actually in place, so I don't know which brands are the better ones. For the most part, I've found that if they are on the shaded side of the house or on a fairly well-shaded portion of the yard, they do quite well. Anything that has a plastic to it will have some UV deterioration. So a porch like what you're talking, where you've got a roof over it, I would think that they would last quite a while. The question would be how much of a cost difference is there between the plastic boards and a pressure-treated board?
Okay. They my neighbor said it was definitely more expensive, but if it's more durable, then it's south facing, so I suppose it does. It's a rental property, so I imagine there is some sun on it.
Well, in that case, when shopping for a product of that style, you want to find one that is rated to have a high UV resistance. They can add some chemicals and such in the process, which will help reduce some of the sunlight deterioration.
Oh, this has been very helpful. Thank you.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Next up, we have Bloomington, Illinois, line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I've also got a flooring question. Mine is about pre-finished versus finished on-site hardwood flooring. Is that something the speaker could address?
Well, I have a limited knowledge on most of that, but I can give it a good whack here.
Well, my particular question is, I understand there are trade-offs for one versus the other, and a pre-finished board may or may not exactly match existing finish. That's not as much a problem for us. We think we've identified an appropriate stain color. But what we really wanted was a flat plank. And we've been told that a pre-finished board, since it won't be sanded on site, will have potential for problems with something called ledging or overboard, where the edges of the boards may not match up very well and there'd be noticeable differences in height. I wondered how common you think that typically is. We were told the difference from one board to the next might be as much as 2 business cards in depth.
Well, that would be extreme. Most of the pre-finished systems I've seen, yes, they do have a little bit of difference when they lay because they put the individual boards down. Hopefully, the underlayment they're putting the boards down over the top of does have a fairly flat surface, so we can get it a lot closer than that. The boards usually do not have a squared off top edge. Usually, they're rounded just a little bit so that they do have a little bit of a transition from one board to the other. I don't think I've ever come across one that would have the depth of what you're referring to, something what in the 10 or 12 thousandths range. That sounds a little excessive. Sounds like somebody got some dirt or something underneath it when they put the board down. But sometimes the boards don't – usually what they'll try and do is plane the boards down and they'll apply the finish. And actually the finish has usually got a chemical or a heat treat to bake it into the wood or to soak it into the wood. I think that some of the pre-finished wood is actually a little bit harder finish than what you're going to get on a sanded floor. But the sanded floor is definitely going to be a lot flatter because you'll butt your boards up together. Then when you sand them, they'll have a very sharp edge to them, which meets up to the one next to it. So you have a lot less gaps or a lot less noticeable gap between the boards.
One of the concerns we had was in order to prevent the overboard or ledging, we would end up with a bevel on these boards, and then we'd have a crack, you know, a noticeable, I won't call it a crack, but the bevels would cause an indentation in every board versus the possibility of overboard.
Well, I will have to say that I haven't seen, like I say, what the extent of what you're referring to. I'm sure that would be a worst-case scenario. Most of the pre-finished boards I've seen, yes, if you were to run a small cart across there with some plastic wheels, they're gonna thump. you're going to notice some differences, whereas a sanded floor is definitely a lot smoother. Kind of depends on your personal preference and your in the final finish. The sanded boards these days, getting a floor sanded is a little on the tricky side, and it requires some patience. And I know that nowadays it's getting harder and harder to find what I'll call a good floor sander. There are still several of them out there, but you have to find somebody that's got a lot of pride in their work to get the floor sanded well. And, of course, it can actually be a little bit more expensive because it does require more time and labor, where most of the pre-finished units are done mechanically, and so we don't have to add in labor costs or time costs. I haven't found that they've been so bad that I would go, oh, my goodness, what happened to this floor? A lot of it has to do with how much moisture is underneath it. If you're over the top of a wet crawl space, then it doesn't matter whether you're using pre-finished or sanded on site, finished on site wood, you can get some warping and such. So you want to make sure whatever your underlayment is good, and that your crawl space or basement area stays nice and dry so we don't get any cupping from underneath. The pre-finished wood does have the disadvantage of if there is a some warping or something in the boards, there's no good way to smooth it back down and refinish it. Whereas a sanded on site or pre-finished or a site finished wood, if there's some irregularities, that they all come out of it when they do the sanding.
I see. If there's time for one more brief question, I've been quoted prices for two different brands of pre-finished wood. One Century and one is Bruce. Do you know if there's any difference in quality between those two?
I've heard of both the names, but I haven't used either one of their products. Most of the time, the major brand names stand behind their product, and they do have a pretty good process for finishing them. So I would not feel apprehensive about using either one of them.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right, very good. Let's go on to Champaign County, line 3. Hello.
Hi. I have a quick question regarding energy efficiency. I'm considering making a considerable investment in that area, but I would like to be able to evaluate some of my different options, let's say a more energy-efficient boiler versus new windows versus added insulation versus something like that. Who makes those kind of or helps you with those kind of decisions?
Very good question. I myself have done in the past energy audits where I've gone through homes and looked for things that were obvious heat losses or obvious air movement problems. There are companies that will use what's known as a blower door, not something that I have access to, but they put basically a big door on the house. They take the prime door off, put a big storm door. It's got some large fans, and they pressurize the house and look for all the air leaks and look to see where the air is coming out. You need somebody that has some knowledge of how the heat is going in and out of the house. Windows can leak heat without actually leaking air. Attic insulation, again, that's one of those things where once you get so much of the attic insulation, the payback on it starts diminishing. You know, once, after you get about 20 inches of insulation up there, adding 22 doesn't do you any good. So there's just several different factors that you'd have to take into consideration. So my guess is you'd want somebody to come in there, a home inspector or somebody that does an energy audit. Probably I would not go with somebody that actually wants to sell you something, because then they tend to want to use their product as the main heat-saving unit.
Right.
So, some type of independent auditor or inspector would be probably the best bet to go through the house and see what they can come up with.
I'm really interested in the cost-benefit analysis of this thing, one versus the other. Which one's going to be a better use of my investment?
Okay. Well, I know I personally don't do the cost benefits. I look at a house when I go through it and say, well, most of your air loss is likely going to be here, but another air loss could be here. And usually I start with the least expensive units as far as what can be done first. I'm not necessarily a big proponent of brand new windows. If a house has a decent set of wood windows with a decent set of storm windows, I don't think you're saving as much as what some of the window companies claim you are, because I think they're comparing apples to oranges with storm windows versus non-storm windows and things like that. So you just need somebody that's had a little bit of experience in it, a good inspector. Call around some of the people in your area and see if they've done something like that and what kind of recommendations they can make.
Okay, thank you.
All right, at least one more caller here. This is Rand Tool, line one. Hello.
Hi, could you give me some information on whether fiberglass insulation is better than cellulose insulation, is better than foam insulation? Can you just talk about that a little bit?
Well, they all have some pros and cons. Foam insulation is going to be, if you're talking about a urethane or a spray-in foam, that's probably the most expensive, but it actually works the best in that it traps the air positively. In other words, there is no air movement through a spray urethane foam insulation. Fiberglass and cellulose, well, there's different applications. They work better for one thing than another. Fiberglass does allow some air movement through it. So if you get a little bit of thermal convection, on a very, very cold day, fiberglass insulation will not insulate as well as on a moderate day, because if there's a greater temperature differential, we do get some thermal convection through the fiberglass, and so anytime we have air movement, all the above are just trying to trap air, and air is your insulator. The cellulose is a little denser, so it reduces some of the thermal convection, but cellulose tends to pack a little bit more. So over time, it tends to settle down to where you don't have as many air pockets in it. And so I would have to say that they all have advantages and they all have some disadvantages. If I were to say what's going to be the tightest, what's going to seal my house the best, the spray urethane foam would probably do that, because it seals out all air and it does not have the thermal convection. It is a little bit more expensive to install. The fiberglass and cellulose are close enough together that in a wall, I'd rather see a fiberglass, because I don't think it'll settle as much. In a ceiling, it doesn't matter to me whether we put a cellulose or a fiberglass. Both of them will do about the same effect.
You were building a new house, what would you use?
I would like to see, you know, depending if cost was no factor, then I would like to see the spray urethane. But since we're looking at, okay, how much energy savings am I get versus how much am I spending money on, a good fiberglass insulation will work. I know there are some companies that are using a wet sprayed cellulose, where they put a screen on the inside of the wall studs and basically spray a wet cellulose in there, and that is supposed to minimize the settling, because it goes in wet enough that most of the settling occurs during installation. Be quite honest, I don't know how well that theory holds up. With the amount of settling I've seen in cellulose in the past, you could end up with cold spots at the top of the wall. So while it sounds in theory like a good project, I'm not sure just how well that works. So if I were doing it myself, and I'll have to admit I would be on a cost of budget, I would probably be using a fiberglass in the wall and a fiberglass in the ceiling. It's quick, it's easy, it's relatively inexpensive. One of the things that most people don't do but can do, you can minimize your thermal dynamics, your thermal transfer, your air movement, your natural convection, by placing a layer of Tyvek over the top of the fiberglass insulation in the attic. Actually, Tyvek house wrap was initially designed and intended as a cover over the top of insulation, and then somebody started using it for the outside of the house and said, wow, this works pretty good. And they pretty much forgot to go back and market its original use, and that was just to lay over the top of the fiberglass to reduce the convection through the fiberglass.
We're going to have to stop. I'm sorry, we're at the end. We got to say thanks to our guest, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He'll be back again next month. Thank you very much.